This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 156. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful blog, website, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Start building your website today at squarespace.com, and when you check out, make sure you enter the offer code IMPROVE at checkout and receive 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. It has to be really, really weird to hear me do the intro. I know it was weird to actually do it, but fear not. We're going to be nerding out about the latest photography news today. And to help me nerd out, we have Jeff. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
So big news from Nikon this week. Actually, was it today, yesterday, day before yesterday, this week? Nikon announced two cameras. They announced their new flagship D5, which is, you know, the big expensive, high-end pro camera. And they also released the D500, which is, it's a crop sensor, but it is a really, really, really good crop sensor. So This is pretty exciting. Jeff, did you have a chance to look at all the specs and stuff?
Yeah. You know, a whole bunch of this had been spilled out even before the official announcement, which is interesting in its own right. Like, why did Nikon, they spilled it before Christmas, which probably killed a bunch of their Christmas sale. Mm-hmm. Maybe they knew it would come so soon after it would be easy to make up the sales in the next month after. But that's interesting. It's interesting that it came out, like a lot of the detail leaked out way before, and interesting that they would give the announcement at CES, which is where, well, I guess it maybe isn't at CES. They just announced it in conjunction with CES. Right,
yeah.
But most camera manufacturers don't really, they save it for other shows to make big announcements like this. So interesting all the way around. When Jim gets back, we'll have to talk to him, I guess, about what he makes out of that sort of a thing that's going on. Right. Or maybe he doesn't care now that he right. ditched Nikon for Fuji.
That's what I was going to say, is now that that Jim no longer shoots Nikon, we no longer have a Nikon shooter on this show. And what's crazy about that is that Nikon is, you know, if this is a Nikon Canon race, right now, Nikon's winning. I mean, there's no way to deny it. I'm a Canon shooter. You're a Canon shooter. Yep. And Nikon is just kicking butt right now. Like,
and honestly, the only reason I'm a Canon shooter is because I fell into it.
Right.
I didn't choose it because I didn't know enough about what I was doing when I got the camera to have chosen it.
And when you're first buying that first camera, really, the cameras are the same. But the thing is, like, once you invest in those lenses, you're kind of, you've bought into that.
Or even the menu system.
Yeah.
You know, you get to know where stuff is, and from
the
from
other model is just a model, mystery. Yeah.
I've had someone come in, you know, several times, people are like, hey, can you help me with the settings on my Nikon? I'm like, I don't even know what to do to change the shutter speed on this. Where's the,
what is this strange dial on the back? That's not the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So let's jump into the specs of the two cameras. The D5, that's the one that's really exciting to me because, you know, with my cameras, I'm always kind of shooting for the stars. I've got my eyes on the best stuff and that's what I daydream about. But
and this doesn't disappoint. It's got some super impressive specs, and the D500 too. So let's I'll walk through them and we'll comment on it. And there's, Jim did manage to make a post about this like right after Nikon announced, made the official announcement, so we have a little bit of commentary from him too, from the Yellowstone trip he's on right now. So here we go. Flagship D5. Okay. It's a 20.8 megapixel FX format. So that's a full frame sensor, 20.8 megapixels, pretty good size for a megapixel camera. It's an Xpeed 5 image processor. So it's an updated version of the image processor that's inside it.
Okay.
3.2 inch, 2.36 million dot touch screen LCD monitor.
Right. And pause right there, because that's different. A touch screen on a pro body that's a first. None of the other really high-end cameras like that have a touch screen. I don't know if I like that or not, because you know, I'm so used to the old way, but you know, we're all so used to our phones. Like, it's just such a intuitive way to flip through photos and to zoom, and it's the way of the future. They're all going to be this way eventually, but this is definitely a first on a pro
body.
And
I think there's two things that would be helpful for touch that's harder without it. One is white balance. If you want to set custom white balance. Now, I know you're good enough. You know, like the Kelvin scale and you know what Kelvin you want to set it to, right?
Yeah, I'm all scientific and stuff.
but if you wanted to do it, you know, on some Canon cameras, what you have to do is you take a shot and then you have to say, I want to use the last shot to set the white balance, and you mm-hmm. pick a point. And it's really hard yeah. to set it in camera for custom. It takes some time. It takes so long. I mean, I tried to do it when I first was getting started because I wanted to get it right in camera. And then I realized it takes so long. It's not worth it. If you change right. scenes from doing portrait shoots or whatever, and you're at one spot and you get the shot and then you move on to a different spot and you have to redo your white balance, it takes too long. So I don't mm-hmm. I do it all in post. And, you know, I set it for something that's kind of generally good, but then as you change spots, it can change. And if you had the ability to just in like live view, click somewhere on the screen and say, that's the white balance, that might be fast enough. Right. I'd consider doing it again.
Yeah. Because this would be just like the eyedropper tool when you're working in Lightroom, you know, in the white yeah. balance portion of the yeah. basic panel, you can take that eyedropper and click somewhere where it's supposed to be white. That would be amazing to do in camera. That'd be so fast.
That's supposed to be what one of the things is. Now, how well it works or not, I don't know, but I know it's selectable white balance point that you can set there in live view.
That's cool.
The other one is even just in reviewing things, especially landscape shooting, pinch to zoom. You could pinch mm-hmm. in on the photo and zoom in live view really well and be able to see kind of validate that you've got your focus right in the front part of the picture, the back part, that you're, yeah. you know, do you have enough aperture to cover all of that? You can go and look at that. And that's just a way more intuitive mm-hmm. way to do it than through the knobs and buttons. And it just doesn't work very well.
And as a night photographer that like I am,
oh, yeah.
that would be so nice because I don't have to try to find my zoom right. buttons.
You'd never use except for those rare exactly. times when you're doing that. So.
And so much more intuitive to explain to people like, yeah, you just, you know, zoom like that and you, right. and you zoom out like that. Like everybody will understand that rather than having to explain buttons and stuff. So,
yeah. So, yeah. Wow. What a feature. It's incredible to see, incredible on a pro camera.
Yep.
All right. More specs here. 4K video recording at 30 frames per second, but there's a serious asterisk on this.
Right. Yeah.
and it's not the same on the D500, according to my understanding. On the D5, it records only 3 minutes of video at a time,
which is so lame sauce. That is just terrible. Like, I mean,
4K.
And so, you know, Jeff and I were talking, if you're buying this camera, you're not buying it to shoot video. Like people are no. not going out to grab this camera for video. Is they would just be way, way overkill. This is for people that shoot professional stills and occasionally want to take a short little snippet of video. And that's really all this camera is going to be capable of doing, because 3 minutes is nothing. Can you imagine resetting your camera, like shooting a wedding and having to reset every 3 minutes?
Right.
That's just ridiculous. So,
and that's kind of what you yeah. could do. You could do 3 minutes and then hit the button right after the end of 3 minutes and try to chain it together.
Right.
The other thing that could be valuable is you can get, if I remember right, it's about an 8-megapixel still that you can pull out of 4K video.
Right.
So that's still a fairly decent megapixel image that you mm-hmm. could get. And so there may be some use cases where you could say, well, I'm just going to take 4K video for the next 3 minutes and I'll make sure that I have a really good frame to choose from then
yeah.
for some shot that you might want to get. So yeah, it's there. 3 minutes makes it pretty useless, but
so for the sports shooters, these next two are pretty big time. It has 153 autofocus point system in it, and 99 of those are cross type. Right. That is crazy. That is so many focus points. And for 99 of them to be cross type, this thing is going to be a focusing beast. I'm really excited to see. Well, I'll probably never get to shoot one. Who am I kidding? Like, yeah, I'm just going to run out and grab one just to test it. No, like, but still, that's an amazing focusing system. And what's really cool about this is the D500 has that same focusing system on it.
Right.
It's got 153 points, 99 of which are cross type. And that's just amazing.
There is a difference between the two because of the sensor size.
Right.
So mm-hmm. even though there's 153 of them, 99 cross type on a full frame sensor, it's still only covering the middle middle part of the sensor.
Right.
It's not getting out to the extreme edges.
Yeah. You're going out to like the thirds.
You know? Right. But on the crop, it's covering almost that whole thing.
Right.
So you don't have to recompose. You have a focus point. Yep. You can get to it and you can set it and not have to recompose.
And the thing about cross type focus points is that they're just way, way better at finding points of contrast. When it's really dark, those are the ones that work. The other ones don't work. So the more cross type focus points you have, the better off you are. Also, right. the ISO performance, according to this, is awesome. I don't know what any of this means because it says its native ISO goes up to 102,400 and the extended ISO goes up to 3 million. And I really want to see what a photo taken at 3 million ISO looks like.
Yeah.
That's just, that's getting into some serious night vision stuff there. I'm willing to bet that nothing above the native ISO is even remotely usable because that's what you have to consider is like, how much of that is actually usable? How good does ISO 6400 look? Anything above that, you know, you kind of expect it to fall apart. But if we can get up to ISO 10,000 without the taste of vomit in our mouths, like this will be an amazing camera. So that's exciting too. That's going to be big for sports shooters.
I like to try to use when describing the ISO stuff. Think of everyone's heard a speaker that is turned up too loud for it to work, right? You hear the tinniness, you hear the garbled nature, like the bass can really sound terrible when you've turned the volume up beyond the capability of a speaker.
Right.
That's kind of what extended ISO is. You're turning the volume, you're taking the signal from the sensor and you're boosting the signal so much and it's just... It really ends up mostly being not usable. So this is marketing stuff for the most part here. Extended ISO is nothing. You won't ever use it at that level. It just doesn't do it. But to say that native gets up to 100, was it 10,000? No, 102,400. That's a big number.
And you know, we all have the crazy uncle that turns the stereo up all the way. Is like, that sounds good, doesn't it? You know, this
yeah,
is.
They do. They think it sounds good. Yeah.
There's going to be people out there shooting it at those crazy high ISOs. And if you're shooting astrophotography, you're going to literally be able to blow out the sky, like completely blow it out, no detail whatsoever. That's kind of cool.
Like, yeah, it would sure be fun to try it,
right?
No
so,
doubt.
So also 12 frames per second, that's no faster than the old one. The 1DX, that was 12 frames per second. This will do 14 frames per second if you're shooting JPEG. So it's not much faster. I saw that they do have a different shutter mechanism. I don't know why it's not much faster if they have a different shutter mechanism, but they do.
The buffer is much bigger though. So 200 shots is a very big improvement from, I can't remember the number from the previous model, but it was not even close to that.
Yeah. That's upwards of 8 seconds.
That's
12 frames per second, 200 shots goes quick, but still that's rattling off a ton of photos. Hopefully most of you won't be rattling off 200 shots in a row. That's not a good practice. And we haven't really mentioned this yet, but this camera is going to be selling for $6,400. So, you know, it's not going to be a purchase that you take lightly. This is one that you're planning for. And the biggest thing about this release is that everybody that owned a D4, your camera is now worth $1,500 less than it was the other day. So congratulations. And so the D500, this one's more like in the realm of possibility for most of the people. Someday, some of you will own one of these cameras. This one comes in at $1,900. Maybe talk about some of the specs on this one.
And it feels very much like Nikon was squarely trying to repeat or replace the Canon offering in the 70 Mark II. Mm-hmm. It's got very similar specs in some, and then a number that are much better than, or not even offered in the 70. So let's go over that. Okay, it's a 20.9 megapixel DX format. So that's just Nikon's term for crop sensor.
Yep.
And the megapixel is pretty similar to the 70 Mark II there. X-Speed 5 image processor. So the same one as the big boy we just talked about. Same touchscreen, but there's a difference. So it's a 3.2 inch 2539K touchscreen LCD, but it tilts. Now it's not articulating. So it's not like some of the lower end DSLRs where it actually like comes out, swivels all the way around, and you can swivel it and make it move in a lot of directions. This only tilts slightly up or down. So you can push on like the top and have it pop out of the bottom a little. But it's enough that if you are shooting kind of low to the ground, you could tilt that screen up and have a decent view of what you're taking. Or if it's way above your head, if you had to hold it up and over the head of a crowd, for example, to try to get a shot, then you could tilt it down and you could get enough of an angle to see it. So that's a pretty cool feature.
And honestly, like, those are the two most useful abilities or directions for a screen to move.
Right.
We're not flipping it around very often.
No.
It's not often that we're shooting behind our back or over our shoulder. So that doesn't bother me whatsoever.
Right. So 4K also in the D500, but this one, I believe, works, even though it's still 3-minute segments that it takes. That's like a file size limitation. The video is so big, it can't write files bigger than what it 3 minutes worth of 4K video is. But it will auto start up to 10 segments. So you can get 30 minutes of video in here. Mm-hmm. No problem. And so why they would do that here and not on the 5? And I hope I'm wrong. Hopefully I'm not understanding correctly. And the 5 does it too. But that would mean this is actually more practical to be able to get video, because it'll be separate files, but that's really easy to deal with on the computer when you string them together. It's no problem at all to just put those all in one thing.
So ISO capabilities of this camera goes up to 51,000 natively. You can expand it to 1,640,000. I'm really skeptical of how that looks.
Right.
You know, it seems like it's got really good ISO performance, 10 frames per second, which is right there with the Canon 7D Mark II.
Yep.
And it has built-in Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and NFC.
So let's talk about that one for a little bit. Wi-Fi, we've used on cameras. Jim's talked about before in the podcast that it does okay, but he hasn't seen it really work well. In fact, his comments that he added, I'll just read his comments that he posted on the website, because he's super skeptical about this. He said, this is the first Nikon camera to contain, they call that Snap Bridge as their marketing term for this functionality, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, NFC. He said, basically, this creates an always-on Bluetooth connection and between your cell phone and the camera, and allows the photographer to push a photo from the camera to a connected cell phone. He said, for me, he'll believe it when he sees it. Everything he's tested, it's been like mediocre in functionality, and he'll see. But so he's very skeptical. I think for me, without having tested it or seen it, I think Bluetooth has a better chance of working well than Wi-Fi does. Wi-Fi is, it sucks up so much battery to push that signal. Bluetooth was, it's still a radio-based technology like Wi-Fi is, but it was designed specifically to be like power efficient and efficient transferring files over the air between things. I watched the Nikon commercial for this, and it's a commercial, so I haven't seen anything. So it still may suck completely. It may be terrible. We'll have to see. But the use case they had was, and we've all done this, you're out at a beautiful scene in the landscape or something that you've got, and you've got your nice fancy camera with you, and you of course are taking some shots, but then you also take a second and you whip out your camera to take the same shot because you want to be able to post it on social media right now. And there's just, it's going to take too long from when you get your nice camera picture off your DSLR and get it online, you know, to actually post it. It's going to be at least that night or something before you do it. The use case here and what they had in the commercial was, you see that scene and your camera is connected to your phone through Bluetooth right now. You take the shot and immediately you have a JPEG of that very same shot on your phone, ready to post to whatever social media you want.
So that's pretty cool.
And that's really cool if it works well.
Right. And another use for Bluetooth is microphones. There's tons of Bluetooth microphones out there. It would be really cool. I don't know if this is a thing yet, but it should be a thing if it's not. I hope they're listening. that having a Bluetooth-enabled Nikon microphone would be awesome for those that are doing video. It'd just make everything so much easier, so much better.
They did say you can control the camera, so you can activate the shutter. You might be able to change the focus through it. I'm not sure. I know the shutter was there, but so you could at least remote shutter release the camera with it.
That's exciting. So then you wouldn't even really need anything like a cam range or anything. You could do all of that through Bluetooth right from your phone with the Nikon app. Wouldn't that be cool? Okay, so before we go on, we want to thank our sponsor, Squarespace. I've been using Squarespace for roughly 2.5 years now. And before Squarespace, my life was a wreck. It was terrible trying to, you know, use WordPress and build my website that way. The pictures were never big enough. I couldn't make it work. And it was just a constant struggle. Then when I got Squarespace, you know, the unicorns and the rainbows came out and life was peachy again. So Squarespace is just really awesome for how easy it is to use. Even Nick can do it. I've recently put up a store and it works. And just the fact that it works is amazing. It all looks good. It's really easy to get your images to display really large. Yeah. Can't say enough good things about Squarespace. That's why they're a sponsor on the show, is because a lot of us use it and it's just awesome. You know, the tools are really intuitive. They just make sense. It's so easy to create a website and keep it updated because it's so easy to add your photos to. So make sure you go over to squarespace.com, use the offer code IMPROVE, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase. If you book it for a year, you're going to get a free domain. So you can't beat that. So Squarespace, build it beautiful. Okay, so moving on, we wanted to talk a little bit about storage strategies. I just bought another 8 terabyte hard drive today. and I was telling Jeff before the show, this brings me up to 36 terabytes worth of storage on my computer. And they're all, like, I've got 3 internal hard drives and I've got 5 external hard drives. And it's just getting a little bit ridiculous because I did not think ahead that, you know, I take a lot of photos and eventually I'm going to need lots of storage space. So I wanted to kind of pick Jeff's brain a little bit about RAID systems. And because I've been shopping around for RAID systems, and the problem with my situation is that I already have like $1,000 invested in hard drives.
Right.
And in order to get into enough storage in a RAID system, I'm looking at spending that again. So if we get this information out to some of you, maybe it's not too late for you. It's too late for me, but it's not too late for you. There's 2 different types of RAID systems. Talk us through it, Jeff. What are we looking at?
Okay, so the system everyone probably already knows and probably most of you own is called direct attached storage. And that's all you've got, Nick, is direct attached storage. All those external hard drives are directly attached to your computer through USB. A lot are doing, if you have a Mac or if you happen to have one of the very few Windows PCs with Thunderbolt, you may have something connected through Thunderbolt, which would be an even faster connection. Drobo, those are direct attached storage. There's some other brands too, but those are, they only connect to your one computer, and it's a great way to do it. In fact, it is faster to do that than a lot of other options for big storage.
Okay.
The other option is something called network attached storage. You can, for the most part, it's much cheaper.
Right.
But there's a reason it's much cheaper, and that's because it is dramatically slower. By nature of the connection, the actual speed of the disks inside of the storage device that you might get can be really, really fast. But it's going to be connected to your computer through like a Ethernet port, or some people try to do wireless. Please don't connect to these things wirelessly. I don't care if you have the brand new best router ever. It's still going to be slower than wired connection for this stuff.
So it say that they're way slower, like how much slower are we talking?
Yeah. All right. So I go through this in a fair amount of detail in an article. So I recommend you go read it if you're interested in this stuff, because you're not going to remember all the numbers. But let's compare USB 3.0 fast 100 megabit Ethernet, which should be pretty standard today. If you have a wired network connection from your computer to this device, that would be, it's called 100 megabit. The speed of that, and let's talk about it in megabytes per second, because we all kind of understand what a megabyte is and how much data that is. You have what would you say your average megabytes are on a single photo?
I get, well, raw files, we're talking like 20.
Yeah, 20, 30, somewhere around there.
Right. And so, then anywhere, like, once you convert those to a JPEG, then you're talking like 2. So
right. So I have a table that's on the article. So to get to the article, I should mention that. Just go over to improvephotography.com. There's a search box and just type in their storage workflow. And my article will be one of the first things to come up. So you can go look at all the gory details, tons of information out there, lots of recommendations on what to do and how to make it work. But I have in there a table that has a 20 megabyte copy time, since that's really common for how big a raw file is. And over Ethernet, that's fast, 100 megabit Ethernet, it takes for a single photo 1.6 seconds to copy from, say, your SD card over to that. Okay, so that's network attached storage. And that may not sound like a lot, but when you've taken 1,000,
yeah,
that's 1,000 seconds that you're sitting there waiting. And even worse than that, imagine trying to go through Lightroom and culling photos, and it's having to pull that over that connection. And it would be like almost 2 seconds before you even see the whole photo come up. It's just, you know, it will make your workflow really slow. And I didn't even put wireless. Well, I did. I put wireless on here, but it's worse. It's not as good.
So what you're saying is, don't work off network attached storage like that. That would be like your long-term storage. You throw it off your hard drives and you just want to put it somewhere before it goes away forever. So when you're done with something, you put it on network attached storage.
That's right.
And so that's USB, the cheap stuff.
USB 3.0, it's 0.03 seconds to copy that same 20 megabyte file. So that's so much faster. That's much more acceptable to wait for that. And that's why it's just fine for you to use a USB 3 external hard drive and edit your files from it. I still think, so personally, the way I would do workflow in this, I'd have an SSD drive in there for your, to store your current shoots.
Yeah.
Whatever you're currently working on. And as soon as you're done with them, you might move them to an external drive, something connected either through Thunderbolt or USB 3. Mm-hmm. When you're done, and maybe that's, you know, I sent the images off to the client, but the client may say they want prints or something later, and I might need to get to it on those external drives. And then when you're really like, okay, I'm actually really done with this, or maybe the drive's full, I need to get some space, I'm going to go pull the oldest stuff off. That's when you put it out on that network attached storage. That's kind of the workflow I recommend using.
So let me walk you through like where I'm at in my predicament. So my current file system is, I have a SSD inside that is dedicated to just working off of. Like I have my operating system on one, and then I have a second SSD drive where I put photos on there. I edit those for the day, and then I move them off onto a spinning drive that is also inside of my computer. And that is like the current year's worth of photos. That's a 6 terabyte hard drive. And then once that year is over and I'm moving on to the next year, I take that entire year's worth of photos and I put them on an external hard drive. Now, the problem with that is that this year, when I went to move those files off onto an external hard drive, I was out of space on my external hard drives. And keep in mind that every hard drive you have, whether it's external or internal, you have to have a backup of it. So, you know, I have a 8 terabyte hard drive that my photos will just barely fit on. And then I have to back that up with another 8 terabyte hard drive. And now that I'm onto a new year, I have to have my internal hard drive clear, and then I have to have another external hard drive to back it up with. So that's the problem with using just like, you know, independent external hard drives, is that you have to back each one up, and then pretty soon they just keep multiplying. You buy in twos instead of ones. And that's the nice part about having one of these RAID systems, is that it backs itself up. Like if you have some kind of failure inside there, from what I understand, like one hard drive fails, you take it out, you stick another one in, and then it does some magic bloopity bloop stuff, and it's all fixed. So
yep, that's right. It can be set up that way. It can also be set up, and most often a Drobo won't be set up that way because it's trying to be as fast as it can. And so it actually is putting like multiple hard drives together as one, not for redundancy, not to make it so that you have the data on multiple places, as much as it wants to leverage, like put one file from your shoot on this drive, another file from your shoot on that drive inside there, two separate drives. drives. Your computer, it looks like a single drive. But then when it goes to read it, if it needs both, it can read from both drives at once rather than having to read both files from a single drive. Does that make sense?
It kind of.
It like combines the performance of the two together.
I see.
So that in that setup, and that's how most of the direct attached storage works. It can be configured differently, but mostly it's not. It's set up to be as fast as possible, which means it's not helping you any at all in redundancy.
Right.
The network attached storage usually is the opposite. It's usually built in order to be redundant because it's intended to be this like permanent place where you're going to store stuff. And it's designed to work that way so that it doesn't, you don't lose stuff. Now you can do a whole lot of stuff here. There's a lot of ways to configure this. So you can get both the redundancy and the performance out of these network attached storage drives, but it's challenging to kind of work through it. And I go through some of that in my article too. So if people are really interested and would like to know more about it, go find the article, read through it. If you have questions, then ask us on the Facebook group and, you know, we'll do our best to answer it. But Nick, for you specifically, I think what you need to do is aim to buy one of these network attached storage devices.
Oh, but they're so expensive.
They are outrageously expensive. Right. But here's how I would do it.
Okay.
Those drives, those external drives that you've got, they're just normal hard drives inside, right?
Yeah.
You could, it would take some work.
I could bust out the soldering iron and just like make one.
No soldering iron. Okay. It's way easier than that.
Okay.
But you could buy maybe like three drives or two drives to put inside of the NAS.
Okay.
You start copying stuff off of your external drives onto them. And then as you empty that drive, you could put that drive inside the NAS.
I see.
And you could slowly build it up. It works best if they're all the same. You have more configuration options about how the RAID works if all the drives are 8 terabyte drives inside. But it doesn't have to. You can do other configurations too that would be very helpful for this. So you can kind of slowly step your way into it. You wouldn't have to, you know, get a drive, get a thing and fully populate it with 8 terabyte drives.
Okay. So like what you're saying is if I got really crazy and just like took the screwdriver and hammered to my external hard drives, the connections on the inside of those are exactly the same as any other hard drive. Like
that's right. Yep.
Oh. That's interesting. The plot thickens. There might be hope for Nick's storage woes.
Yeah, but, that's right.
So, you know, the point of this is that I want all of you guys out there to think about your long-term storage plan. Because you kind of, when I went into this, I didn't have any kind of plan. I was just like, I'll buy another hard drive. And then, you know, 7 hard drives later, here I am. Don't end up like me. Kind of have a plan and grow into your plan rather than grow out of your current situation.
Now, the other thing I wanted to point out in your story that maybe some other people haven't thought of yet would be how you're organizing your photos. Mm-hmm. You mentioned how you're going to take 1 year and move them.
Yeah.
You probably have it organized so that everything you shot for the year is under a certain folder that's for that year. Yep, right.
Exactly.
And you've organized it that way, probably because you learned that it's really bad. It ends up being really bad later if you don't.
I made a whole lot of mistakes before that to get to this point.
And like, most people do. Most people they just scatter them everywhere. Oh, there's just, and Lightroom keeps track of them for you. So it's fine until you run out of space. And then it's a nightmare to figure out how am I going to move the photos I don't care as much about right now, the old stuff, to something else so that I can free up space. And if you organize it so that you put everything under a year, that's super easy to just move. I mean, it's going to take some time. There's going to be a lot of data, but you can, you know, drag the folder off into the new drive and then go eat lunch and might be done by the time you get back.
Well, you might be able to eat lunch. I will be able to take a small vacation because yesterday morning, I started moving just my 2014 folder, which is like much smaller than my 2015 folder. And that took, I want to say 15 hours, something like that, because it was like four terabytes worth of photos. And so,
And that will be slower when you do it over the network.
Right.
So it'll worse. Quite a bit worse. It's okay. You just, you know, you start it before you go to bed then and let it go all night and see how far it got. And it might even take into the next day, but that's, At least it's going to be a way to remedy the problem. If you have them all over the place, there's still Lightroom can still help you a lot, especially if you use Lightroom to move the files.
Yes. And that's a big deal right there. Like anytime you're going to be moving files from one hard drive to another or anything like that, do it right in the library module of Lightroom. That way Lightroom knows where everything is and you don't have to try to find it and then tell Lightroom where it is. You skip a couple steps just by doing it right inside Lightroom.
In fact, that's probably the way I'd recommend if you have them in a scattered mess today. You search for the files by date. Lightroom will be able to show you that. And then you can grab the oldest ones or all of them, say, from 2015. And you can create a folder somewhere that's 2015. And then tell Lightroom, move all of them over into that folder.
Yep.
And now at least you have them all under a single folder.
Right. Your mess is only going to get worse if you wait. So do it now. Don't do what I did. Do it now. It's so much better to start organized in the beginning when you have very few photos and then just stick with whatever your plan is. It doesn't matter what your plan is, as long as there's a method to your madness. Start with it early and then just stick with it. And then you'll always know where stuff is. All right. So every week we like to share with you some of our doodads that we are using, we're loving, because we all love doodads. Jeff, what is your doodad this week?
All right. Mine is, it's something, well, so I just got a GoPro for Christmas.
Oh, nice.
It's kind of fun. I haven't used it much yet. I just barely got the mounts. I didn't realize you had to get those too. So,
oh yeah. Yeah.
So I've got the mounts and planning to go use it this weekend. It'd be kind of fun to play around with. It's, you know, nothing serious. It's a toy, but it's fun. And, but I needed some micro SD cards to go in it. And I had never bought a micro SD card because I had never had a purpose for it until that. But I also recommended someone else get one in our Facebook group recently. And it's because they bought a Microsoft Surface. And if you're not familiar with those, they're tablet-like devices, but that are also really actually fairly powerful PCs, Windows PCs. So you can kind of, it has a detachable keyboard thing. And when you detach it, it acts very much like a tablet. When you attach the keyboard and when you use the kickstand in the back, you can connect a mouse to it and even an external display. And it's really a pretty full-fledged computer. It's a pretty nice device for people who are on the go. They like Windows and want to do photo editing. It will run Lightroom and Photoshop, the normal non-mobile versions, just great. And it's a nice thing, but it's very limited on storage. I think the max was either 128 gig or 256 gig. I can't remember which. And that works for a little bit. It might not work for Nick more than about a week.
I could look at it and fill that thing up.
Yeah, exactly. But it's very limited on storage. And so I had a listener ask, what should I do about my storage for this? Should I get a USB 3 device or what USB 3 external drive do you recommend to make it a fast device where I can put my photos and have Lightroom work well? And my advice was different. I thought it's got a micro SD card slot in it. So rather than giving up, I think there's only maybe two USB ports on the thing. And if you're going to plug in a mouse, you're down to one. So rather than that, or even having to drag around an external hard drive with you while you're on the go, get a 128 gig micro SD card, stick it in there and forget about it.
Yeah.
Just leave it in there. And that's what they're doing. And I'll be excited to hear how they come back. But it's on the same kind of controller as a USB 3 port is. So it should be really comparable speeds to USB 3 to getting to that 128 gig SD card. Now, the card itself is probably, it's not as fast as a full-sized SD card. That's just, you know, physics. The wires are tiny on that thing. Those things are so small.
Yeah.
So they're not quite as fast, but it's certainly going to be fast enough. The Lightroom should work well. It means it like doubled his drive space, right? Mm-hmm. What's available to him in on this little tablet-like device now got doubled for, I think it was like $60. Yeah. So that's my doodad of the week. If you've got one of these new devices that's really limited on storage space, like a MacBook Air, you could just, you know, get a SD card and stick it in there and leave it in there. And use that for some space while you're on the go. And if you get home and then it's a nice way actually to transfer it to your main computer too, because they're all in that card and you move them over and it's a good way to expand your storage.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. I bought that exact card last week because there's a really good deal on it right now.
Yeah.
So I've got a 128 gig card in my phone right now. It's pretty sweet.
Right.
Okay, so mine this week is Spotify, and not only Spotify, but the Deep Focus playlist inside of Spotify. When I'm editing, I just want to like zone out and get in this trance, and Deep Focus is really good for that because, you know, it just kind of, it's just like this mellow music that you kind of groove to and you nod to, and you just are so productive. I listened to the Photo Taco that Jeff did about the music to code by, and I bought that and I loved it, but you can only listen to the same few songs so many times before it starts driving you nuts. So the Deep Focus playlist in Spotify, it's worked well for me lately. I've been listening to it pretty much nonstop.
Okay. Do you get up in your sessions? So you like get focused for a half hour and then stand up and move around and get a drink?
Yes, I do. Okay. Mostly because I'm so heavily caffeinated, I have to go to the bathroom like every 15 minutes.
Oh, that works, I guess.
I'm also really well hydrated. So that does it for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for the download. And we will see you in another 7 days. Bye-bye.